wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this June 22nd Monday. I want to send out a big thank you to the dedicated KBOO staff who, for these last few months, have kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. Juneteenth has come and gone, but the work continues in the streets and on the airwaves. And this morning on The Old Mole, we contribute to the conversation and struggle with Bill Resnick interviewing Garrett Rappenhagen, National Director of Veterans for Peace. They discuss how to stop Trump's efforts to stay in power and do it in part by enlisting the force of the U.S. military to suppress its own citizens. Jan Hawken talks with Lauren Regan, attorney and executive director of the Civil Rights Defense Center in Eugene. Regan reflects on the recent Black Lives Matter protests and police responses, as well as tactics of resistance in the movement against policing. Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews Katherine Ryan Hyde's 2020 novel, Brave Girl, Quiet Girl, a novel about friendship, motherhood, and the journey towards finding a place to call home. From the archive, Bill Resnick talks with Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing, about how popular police reforms fail to address the problems of, let alone the reasons for, over-policing. Alex Vitale spoke in Portland last October 2019. This interview originally aired in September 2019. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like The Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Garrett Rappenhagen.
Hi, Garrett Rappenhagen. Welcome again to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Garrett Rappenhagen grew up in a military family. His father, a Vietnam veteran, both grandfathers serving in World War II. He was a cavalry scout sniper in the Army's 1st Infantry Division. Garrett completed a deployment in Kosovo on a 9-month peacekeeping mission in the early 2000 period. And he also was on a combat tour in Baklava, Iraq. He got disillusioned with the war, gained an honorable discharge in 2005, and immediately began working as a veterans advocate and a dedicated activist. Among other organizations, he served as chairman of the Board of Iraqi Veterans Against the War. He worked in Washington, D.C. as a lobbyist for the Nobel Prize-winning Veterans for America, and he was program director for Veterans Green Jobs. He's now the executive director of Veterans for Peace. Garrett, the Veterans for Peace recently issued a position paper titled Veterans Condemn Deployment of Troops. Read us some of the important excerpts.
Sure, I'll briefly read some of it here. Veterans for Peace condemns the inflammatory statements of Donald Trump, his declaration of calling for military troops on U.S. soil to quell people exercising their First Amendment right is inflammatory and incredibly dangerous. We stand unequivocally with the protesters who are in the streets calling for an end to senseless police killings and white supremacy. In addition to the 200,000 troops already deployed across the world, U.S. cities are being occupied by military force. Thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and police have been deployed to the cities across the nation as Trump calls on the military to dominate the streets and that he'd override any local control if governors refused to deploy the National Guard. Threats and intimidation are tactics of terror by this administration. Trump's statements, as well as past statements, are incendiary and effectively declare war on our communities. Veterans for Peace calls on all active duty military leaders and personnel to refuse deployment. We as veterans know the terrible aftermath of participating in actions that are morally wrong against communities in other countries. Now is the time to refuse to participate in orders that are unjust.
Yeah, that's a strong statement. Garrett, why did VFP, Veterans for Peace, put out that statement? What were your concerns?
Well, I think, first of all, we don't want to see our U.S. military being used against peaceful protesters that are demanding to stop the violence in their communities by police officers, demanding to see equality and to challenge white supremacy. So we don't want to see an end to these just actions. We think that really there's no peace without justice, and we need a more equal and just society to really achieve that peaceful end. And deploying military troops into our communities to suppress it is definitely the opposite of peace that we try to achieve for Veterans for Peace. And we know that deploying troops, we're going to see more innocent people killed, more protesters have every right to exercise their constitutional rights being killed. And we've already seen it in Kentucky. A man was killed by a guardsman, and we're going to see that continue. And it's violence that I don't think we've seen in our streets by the military since Kent State. So, you know, we know how we operate in a military combat zone, and we know that our National Guardsmen and our federal troops, if deployed, will act in similar fashion to put down any threat towards them with mass amounts of violence. And it's going to be morally damaging to the people, to the soldiers who are deploying, as we see it in all other countries that we occupy. It's leading to situations where you're going to kill bystanders, you're going to kill innocent women and children, and you're going to be killing people who basically will put you on the wrong side of a civil rights movement in this country. I don't think that most service members signed up for that. The atrocities that we do overseas, certainly awful, and it'll be no different here in our own country as we're killing our own citizens.
One of the things that I think motivates a lot of us, including Generals Mattis and Mullen, who are the old gray, retired, very popular, though, men from the Joint Chiefs and General Mattis himself. My sense is that this could be the dress rehearsal, that is, sending troops into the cities. Many cities, they were on active duty, or at least deployed there, as a dress rehearsal for what might happen in the election. That is, if Trump sees himself losing, if he sees that the voter suppression by the Republicans doesn't work, that he appears to be a loser, he has signaled in so many ways that he doesn't want to step down. I have the sense right now that some of his people and his signals, his dog whistles about people being in the streets that he loses, he's going to try and declare martial law or something like that and ask the military to enforce it and go into the cities and make sure that the demonstrators stay in their homes or get shot in the street. It's not just alarmist. Even the Washington Post and New York Times have editorialized people arguing this is something we have to be ready for. What's your sense?
Well, I think that, you know, anything is possible. I don't think that President Trump is removing any options from the table, as they say. I'm sure he was trying to see whether the military would fall in under his command and do something like this, as just seeing where the sense of control he has over the military itself. You know, I don't know what these retired generals in this senior level leadership is thinking when they actually finally challenged the president on these issues. It's good that they're coming out against him on these things, but I want to put a few warnings out there. One, it gives a false sense of integrity of the U.S. military command when in a lot of senses it still is self-serving. There are worries, I think, within senior level leadership that the faith and the belief and support of the U.S. military will fracture if stressed, a lot like it had done towards the end of the Vietnam War, where there was less and less public support for the U.S. military. And I don't think they want to see that happen. You know, I think that general people will feel that because these senior level military people might be challenging Trump or at least have some amount of dissension from him, that they just follow their morals and ethics on the battlefield, which we know is not always the case. We've seen it in Afghanistan, we've seen it in Iraq, we've seen it all over the world for a long history. Just want to remind people that, you know, the atrocities that happened in Abu Ghraib, there's still only an E5 as the highest level soldier that was convicted for any sort of atrocities associated to Abu Ghraib. It's not an ethical, moral institution to begin with, so don't feel like they're going to always do the right things and follow their conscience when ordered to do something. Be prepared for that. If it's possible and it's serving for the military, I think that they'll occupy American streets if the opportunity arises.
You know, I agree with you completely. It's not for any sort of moral reason or even civil libertarian reason. They're just afraid that enough people will turn against them such that it becomes a lot easier if they do move in that direction in any way. The retired generals, they were afraid that if they moved into the cities this time around, they would lose a lot of support. Instead, in fact, they gained support. It was very good for the institution of the army. It may not be good for the people if, in fact, things get chaotic. Well, there's so many crises now facing America, climate change as well as inequality. All of them could turn into severe crises, especially climate change, if food supplies begin disappearing. Eric, in the position paper, Veterans Condemn Deployment of Troops, VFT also points out, we as veterans know the terrible aftermath of participating in actions that are morally wrong against communities in other countries. Tell us about the terrible aftermath. It seems to me there's so many dimensions of it. Give us a sense of what you see as the aftermath of completely unjust wars and killing.
Yeah. When explaining the two major aspects of who really suffers in war, there's the people of the countries that are typically occupied by unilateral, overwhelming military force on the U.S. side. And then there's the veterans who are serving there. And I just want to say that there's no equality there. The service members, their home countries are not being occupied. They're not being suppressed and terrorized by an armed force. Their loved ones aren't in harm's way being killed. Their way of life are rarely being upset to such a degree that their whole world is being turned upside down. The people on the brutalizing end of these occupations are certainly the people who are being occupied. In this new scenario, those people are going to be American citizens. And I also don't want to put any sort of additional value on American lives than anybody else's lives. So that being said, there's also the veteran side of the things. You know, the military who's actually going out there and doing this. Many of us who serve in the military are doing it for economic reasons, are in a situation where they're looking for opportunities to advance, to increase their social economic situation, and they're in a rough spot, and the military is a way to move forward out of whatever situation they're in. That's not everybody. Obviously, there's a great degree of just patriots, people who have military service in their traditional family systems and other things that drive people to military service. But when you take the battlefield and you know, you're taking other lives, whether they're American or anybody else's, there's a weight upon you that you're not trained for. They train you in the military how to kill, and they do it very good nowadays. I was very excellent at my job as a sniper in Iraq. But they don't teach you what happens to you psychologically and emotionally and morally after you take someone's life. And the ambiguity of the conflict that you're in, the causes of why you're there, also impact how that weighs upon your soul. And, you know, I struggle with moral injury every single day. The amount of shame that I feel for participating as a perpetrator of violence of people in Iraq is intense. Some days it's so debilitating that I can't get out of bed, that I punish myself for being happy because I feel like I should punish myself because my society treats me like a hero. You know, I've sabotaged great relationships with lovers, family members, friends, sabotaged job opportunities just because I felt the need to punish myself and go in a very dark place. And you can imagine the amount of moral injury that a soldier is going to feel once he draws down a weapon on a person from his own community and kills them when they're only trying to advocate to end police violence in their communities, to highlight how there's still not equality in this country, that the economic divide is vast, that people aren't addressing the colonization and white supremacy and the racism in this country. That's something that is, I think, going to be a massive burden and a massive toll on service members if they take the streets of America. Right now, we lose about 22 veterans a day to suicide. You know, those numbers are going to be, 22 a day is going to be very small compared to the regret and the remorse that people are going to feel if they actually take the streets of America.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Garrick Repenhagen. Comes from a long-term military family, served as a sniper in Iraq, gained himself an honorable discharge and came home to work as an anti-war activist. He's now national director of the organization Veterans for Peace. We've been discussing a Veterans for Peace position paper, Veterans Condemn Deployment of Troops, asking troops to refuse to obey Trump's morally unjust and illegal order. We discussed how this could be a dress rehearsal for Trump and his supporters to not step down if it appears he'll lose, maybe to declare martial law, go into the cities, and the protesters will be discussed as terrorists and treasonous, and the military will be on orders to dominate the streets, whatever that means. It means shooting a lot of people. Garrett, let's talk about what can be done to avert that kind of crisis where the U.S. military is ordered into the streets of this country. What can be done right now?
Well, I think on the highest level, putting pressure on governors in local areas is really important. Donald Trump threatened governors that if they didn't mobilize their National Guard, that he would send in federal troops. Some of that has been walked back a little bit, I think, but the threat still remains, and I think governors need the political backbone by their communities, telling them that this is not something that they want, to make it very clear that their future elections might count on this decision that they make. Force Trump's hand. If he feels necessary to send federal troops, then at least it's not the governor and the local state National Guard that's in the city streets. Let's try to burn the federal system and really call Trump's bluff. So I think putting pressure on governors is obviously important. Continuing to put pressure on all your elected officials, I think, is really important. But also on the local level, on the smallest level, if you know somebody who's in the military or you know somebody who's in the National Guard, reach out, talk to them, have these conversations with them. It's good and well for these high-ranking military officials to say what they want to say, but ultimately it's the lowest level person that's going to be on the ground having to make the decision to pull the trigger or not. And I'd rather them not be in a situation where they're afraid for their lives or they're afraid of their military command giving the orders and just not even be present on the streets. So let's talk to them. There's resources. There's the GI Rights Hotline, the Military Law Task Force, Courage to Resist, About Face Veterans Against War, and Veterans for Peace, all standing by to receive calls and emails to help you find the resources that you need if you're in the service and you want to get out and you want to refuse orders.
What about what civilians can do now beyond talking to people in the military or in the police in the United States who will be asked to join the military, and in fact, connections between the police and the FBI and the military and Homeland Security and even private policing forces is increasing. It's a huge number of people now, all with guns. On the other side, it seems to me most people are not interested in having martial law declared and the Constitution put in the closet for a while, they say, before they call elections, which are never called or are so rigged that create a one-party state. But civilians, it seems to me, we have to present a threat of a general strike or of some way of people just refusing to go along with a military occupation. It seems to me that that creates some degree of reticence to do it amongst the military and the political elite that might back Trump. What's your sense?
General strike is always great. I don't know if we have the critical mass in labor organizing at this point to be able to pull off something that'll be effective, but we should keep working towards that. I think withholding our labor is an amazing tool for change. But you also see these protests, you know, are becoming very effective. You see policies in local communities are changing, talking about reduced military spending and police spending. I know in Denver, Colorado, which is the closest large city to me where I'm at, the police budget is about a third of the tax dollars spent in the city. We can have some influence there. I think if we stay in the streets, we keep supporting Black Lives, reach out to the local organizations like Movement for Black Lives and other local coalitions to see how you can show up and how you can be effective and work with folks to keep out in the streets, I think is really powerful. I'd like to see more military veterans out there. I think having the military veteran community oppose these deployments and mobilizations, I think, is really critical right now. You know, we keep pushing veterans for Black Lives and Stand Down for Black Lives as a way to kind of show our support for people of color in this time, and also show that we don't want military forces in our streets. And we want to demilitarize our police forces. Let's keep out there and keep active. And I think it's starting to really make a difference. I'm curious, not on the highest level of elections this year, where we're talking about the presidential elections, because I don't have a lot of faith in Joe Biden as president either. But I think on local congressional elections and state elections that we're going to see a massive shift because of the popular culture is moving away from the status quo, away from the colonized forms that we're used to seeing, away from what white supremacy. And I think we're going to have a lot more progressive leaders take positions of power on a local level. And I think that has a way of really changing a lot of things.
Jared, I remember when a big veterans contingent went to Standing Rock and that struggle around the Keystone Pipeline. The veterans there, it was a tremendous boost for the movement. Jared Reppenhagen, keep up the good work.
If you and your listeners are out there supporting us, there's no way we're going to leave the streets. So thank you for your support.
Thank you for your work. So long.
They call us all extremists because we're out here in the street. How unpatriotic. Veterans for peace. They say we got to watch them like never before. Because there's nothing more dangerous than veterans against war. They stand on every corner with hammers in their hand, taking film and snapping pictures of everything they can. Upload photos, write reports on everything they saw, protecting all our citizens from folks who broke no law.
Next up, we have Jan Hawken talking with Lauren Regan, attorney and executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene.
Welcome to KABU, Lauren Regan.
Thank you, Jan.
Well, you and others at the Civil Liberties Defense Center have for years provided legal representation and trainings for activists, and particularly those engaged in direct action and civil disobedience. Well, with the mass protests since the murder of George Floyd in Minnesota on Memorial Day, a movement has arisen around the country and around the world calling for major police reforms, including some demands for defunding or abolishing police departments. So let's start with what you are seeing now in terms of how police themselves are responding to the protests, perhaps beginning with the streets of Portland and Eugene, where you're located.
Well, in terms of what we're observing by law enforcement, you know, number one, we are witnessing some of the most militarized police that we have seen in recent times, paired with an overwhelming, indiscriminate use of illegal force. The standards for the use of force are that a police officer is only allowed to use that amount of force which is reasonably necessary under the circumstances. And in order to use force upon someone, they have to be doing something individualized and specific. For instance, they have to be resisting arrest. They have to be fighting with police, using weapons or brandishing weapons. You know, there has to be something that justifies the use of force.
Doesn't that also include interfering with police being able to carry out their duties? That's, I think, a kind of vague area, but is that included?
In an individualized way, that is true. But there is also the reality that if a large group of people is, you know, for instance, marching in the streets, it is unreasonable for law enforcement to immediately order that entire crowd onto the sidewalk or face CS gas, tear gas, or rubber bullets or other types of force. There is always a balancing. And it is not a dictatorial situation where law enforcement gets to basically make a decision and then everything else be damned. And so I think that there is a long line of case law that is supposed to form the boundaries of what is reasonable force. You know, when police misconduct and excessive force goes into the courtroom, which of course, you know, we recognize that that courtroom is itself an entity that is plagued with systemic racism. You know, so I'm not saying that the courtroom is somehow this laboratory of unbiased neutrality or anything like that. But when federal civil rights actions are filed alleging that law enforcement has violated people's constitutional rights, whether that be hindering First Amendment rights or brutality and excessive force, when it goes into the courtroom, the case law that has been built over decades becomes sort of the boundaries that the judge is supposed to look to guide its decision on whether or not a police officer's actions were reasonable and whether the force used was excessive. And so, you know, we are in pretty unprecedented times right now in terms of the use of militarized police and their weapons and technology that they are using against, you know, activists and people who are taking the streets. And I think often, you know, we hear the term, you know, quote unquote, nonviolent protesters. And I think that that has kind of become a shorthand label to define the majority of people who are showing up to these marches, you know, the majority of people from our community that are showing up in solidarity. They're there to march. They're there to exercise their rights. They're not there to do acts of economic sabotage or property destruction or to, you know, confront and antagonize law enforcement. That is the overwhelming majority of people who are often showing up to these events. But those are also people who are then victimized by the use of tear gas and rubber bullets and whatnot. And when cops come out and use that kind of force on crowds, it causes those folks to rethink whether or not they're going to leave their homes and come and join in those protests.
I mean, this is a tactic of the police and the state for repression. Absolutely. It's not just rogue cops. Talk some about the point you're making, the legal grounds police have for more aggressive or violent tactics. And one of the grounds is what's called reasonable fear, and that's been part of the demands for reform is challenging this stance where police can say, I felt a fear or threat in my life. And now, of course, in a way, the police do have a reasonable fear because there's discussion of, you know, there are mass protests on the streets and many calling for abolishing many of these institutions. Can you talk about that issue of reasonable fear and how it's worked in policing and how it's being challenged now?
Well, I think that that is an issue that at its core is also about state power and state control, because the state creates a narrative that it disseminates that justifies the notion that cops should be afraid of us. We're afraid of cops. You know, that whole narrative was created by the institutions that then perpetuate that violence. You know, I think it's too easy to basically say that the use of force by law enforcement is reasonable because people are chanting ACAB, for instance. The law says that as trained public servants who are given the power to kill other humans, law enforcement is one of the only professions in the world that, when licensed, is licensed to kill other humans.
Like the military.
Yeah, but even more so, I think, because police are supposed to be working with civilian populations, not on a battlefield. There is almost more consent when you're talking about soldiers in a war zone, though I will note the Geneva Conventions actually forbid the use of chemical weapons on battlefields, unlike in our streets, as we are all being forced to suck up tear gas while a respiratory pandemic is going on. So I would say there's even a heightened duty with regard to law enforcement.
And you're talking in part about the position of the police as an agent of the state, and you mentioned that several times. How important do you think it is, the analysis of the police itself and how we understand policing as an institution and as an instrument of the state versus the most direct and immediate and visible display of police brutality on the streets?
Well, I think, again, you know, the state and its power to manipulate reality and facts and to kind of push a tainted version of the facts to the people is definitely a problem. And I think, you know, as most people know at this point, the origins of policing were basically to hunt down, quote unquote, escaped slaves. And so the origins of the policing system within the U.S. has at its core racism and discrimination. I would say some parts that are coming up that are somewhat positive in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder are things like real conversations about defunding police. Law enforcement, police departments, their budgets have only ballooned over the years where social services, education, other things have been gutted. And there are a lot of places around the country that are now talking about taking that money and putting it to social services, social work, mental health, community programs that will actually keep everyone in a community safer. And I think that is a good starting point. I think there are some police departments like that in Minneapolis that are under threat of being disbanded. You know, something that we never thought, you know, we would hear during the Trump regime, people actually completely abolishing law enforcement. But these are conversations that are long overdue. Many of us have been talking about that for a long time, and we're told that it was, you know, fantasy land to be talking about that. And so this is an opening. You know, this is a moment in time, a historic moment where people need to take advantage of it. And I don't mean that in a weird way. I mean that just, for instance, here in Eugene, we realized that Eugene police policy not only had a carotid neck restraint that was permissible, but it was actually more expensive than that in Minneapolis. And as a result of the times that we are in, the city of Eugene just quote unquote suspended and hopefully will repeal that policy for law enforcement. So local levels, you know, are always really important when it comes to police misconduct and citizen police accountability. Now is the time for everybody, regardless of where they live, to be digging in to the work that needs to be done in order to make their communities more safe from police misconduct and police brutality.
Lauren, you've been working for a very long time on the climate movement, activists engaged in civil disobedience and other forms of direct action that also raise the question of how marginalized communities, communities of color, have suffered the worst effects of that crisis, as well as the pandemic and the economic crises that we're living through. How do you see this movement we're in now around policing extending into or furthering a conversation around the climate emergency and its impact on marginalized communities?
Well, I think right now this movement is centered on Black and communities of color. It is led by those communities, and that is important and needs to be respected. I think that personally, we know and understand that many people who are suffering from environmental injustice, you know, and the worst consequences of climate change do tend to be communities of color and poor communities. And so there is very much crossover between issues regarding climate and issues regarding race and economic status, you know, and things of that nature. So they are definitely related, but I would just say that as the white lawyer, it is certainly not my position to be asserting climate activism into this movement that is being led by POC communities.
But perhaps this is part of conversations we have to have or hope to have over time, and what it means to build a more caring and life-sustaining society and world. So hopefully that can be continue to be part of those conversations over time.
I mean, the reality right now with the climate crisis, that scientists, without caring about what color skin a person has, are predicting that in approximately 10 years, there is no turning back from climate change. And we also know that industrialized countries, countries with economic privilege, are the biggest contributors to it and will likely be the most resilient to it as well. And so just like the issue of drinking water and having safe water to drink, fighting climate change and fighting the impacts from climate change, including where are you going to get your food and where are you going to get clean water, you know, those are issues that affect everyone. And hopefully, you know, there can be some unification, you know, around different social movements and environmental movements, where we do realize that, you know, what unites us is stronger than what divides us, and that at some point we, the people, will have to come together against the profiteering corporations that literally have their knee on our necks. You know, I mean, there is definitely some analogy between what's going on now and the broader climate movement. But I also think that we have seen around the world fossil fuel companies or other giant profiteering corporations and industries participating in extrajudicial assassinations and killing of activists to silence them. So you don't need state power or state authorization to harass or terrorize civilian populations and activists. You know, that has been something that in other parts of the world, activists have dealt with for a very long time.
Thank you so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken talking with Lauren Regan with the Civil Liberties Defense Center, Eugene, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Jan, and I hope everybody stays safe and healthy.
You as well.
Here's the place where I take my stand. Take my stick and draw a line in the sand. Show my hand. Initiate the actions plan. Now give me time for us all to give me back my claim.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM listener-supported community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday, June 22nd. Next on the Old Mole, Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews Katherine Ryan Hyde's 2020 novel, Brave Girl, Quiet Girl, read by Patricia Kohlberg.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and today I'm reading a review for Book Mole Larry Bolden. Quote, I started whispering in her ear, but so quiet I wasn't sure she could even hear me. It was more like making the words with my lips against her ear, but then just this tiny breath of air that was the sound. I said, brave girl, quiet girl. She said it back to me, just as quiet, which really surprised me. She stopped her run up to that big cry and whispered back to me, brave girl, quiet girl, right in my ear. She didn't really get the qua sound in quiet. I think she was too young to have gotten the hang of that sound. But anyway, I knew what she meant, so what difference did it make? End quote. Katherine Ryan Hyde's 2020 novel, Brave Girl, Quiet Girl, begins with a violent carjacking. Brooke, a divorced single mom, is driving her mother's expensive Mercedes with her 2-year-old daughter, Etta, strapped into her car seat in the back. But she is dragged from the car by the thief and watches helplessly as the car drives off with her daughter still strapped in. This occurs in the first few pages of this frightening and yet lovely book about Brooke, Etta, and Molly, a 16-year-old homeless girl. Molly is with her also homeless male friend late at night when she spots Etta still strapped in her car seat on the sidewalk. With no phone, no money, and no idea how Etta got there, Molly is faced with the daunting challenge of returning the little girl to her family. I have sometimes put aside one of Hyde's many novels because it seems just too sentimental, too sweet, too full of pathos. And this novel is certainly high on the pathos scale. And yet it captured me early on, gripped me, and I just could not stop reading it until I was finished. Molly is homeless and on the streets because she's been tossed out of her home in St. George, Utah, and told not to return unless and until she has shed the devil that she has brought into her family home. Molly, under pressure from her girlfriend, had decided to come out to her mother, and that is what her mother labels bringing the devil into the home. I won't divulge much of the story here, but I will tell you that the reader is kept on tenterhooks during the early phases as Molly tries to care for little Etta and to hide her away from other street youths who intend to grab her from Molly and hold her for ransom. Molly had helped raise her 2 younger sisters and so is a competent and loving caretaker, but with no funds for food or diapers for the toddler. After several very frightening events, Molly is finally able to race after a police car with Etta holding on for dear life, and thus begins the reuniting of Etta with her mother, Brooke. Initially, Brooke is angry with the young girl, not understanding why she did not alert the police earlier or find a way to call Etta's mother in spite of the fact that there is an Amber Alert out for her. The rest of the novel is devoted to the interactions of mother and daughter and the intervention of a sympathetic female police officer who firmly but gently leads Brooke into a better understanding of Molly's heroic actions in saving Etta. Although Brooke herself has a very troubled relationship with her own mother, she assumes that Molly must have done something horrible or unlawful to have provoked her mother into forcing her from the home. She decides to drive from California to St. George to confront Molly's mother and to hopefully get Molly back into her family home. When Brooke finally confronts Molly's mother and learns of her super fundamentalist religious beliefs that treat homosexuality as a dreadful sin and a chosen lifestyle that can be discarded like a filthy cloak, she begins to reassess Molly and to try to care for her in something like the loving ways Molly has cared for Etta. While the plot is what drives this novel, it turns out to reveal a deep understanding of street kids and the many different reasons that people find themselves homeless and living on the streets. I find myself very impressed by both Hyde's excellent storytelling and her desire to talk about social issues and the meaning of love. Baby Etta loves Molly from the start and calls out, "Molly, Molly, Molly," whenever she sees her. While it takes much longer for Brooke to begin to see the sterling qualities of Molly, the relationship that develops between the two women is heartening. I suppose there will be some readers who find this book to be corny and much too sentimental. I thought it to be a beautiful story about love and redemption. I have been talking about Katherine Ryan Hyde's novel, Brave Girl, Quiet Girl. This is Patricia Kohlberg reading for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
It's hard enough, I know. find the strength to go back to where it all began. It's hard enough to gain an attraction in the rain. You know it's hard for me to understand. Hard to find a way.
We end this morning's program with Bill Resnick and Alex Vitale talking about his 2017 book, The End of Policing. Vitale was in Portland in October last year, 2019. This interview aired in September 2019 and is as relevant today as it ever has been.
Alex Vitale, welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Alex Vitale teaches at the Brooklyn College in New York City's university system. He coordinates the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project. He wrote a magnificent book, The End of Policing, published in 2017. He's an engaged academic, lots of TV and radio interviews, does visits around the country, consulting with citizen police reform groups, and also talking with those police forces and some public officials who realize that modern policing is very harmful, even to the individual cops themselves. That is, policing has to change. Alex Vitale, it's really a wonderful book, but first, what's wrong with modern policing?
Well, I think we have a pretty good sense of what the major problems are. Over the last 5 years with the rise of Black Lives Matter, we have a very good understanding about the excesses of police violence and the lack of accountability. I think what needs more attention is the broader problem of over-policing. So we focus so much on a handful of very high-profile injustices, but we sometimes lose track of the 10-plus million low-level arrests police make every year that really do almost nothing to make us safer, but that really just drive more poor people into the criminal justice system. So despite all the activism and upheaval of the last 5 years, I haven't seen a whole lot in the way of really meaningful changes to American policing. We've seen a few training programs here and a lot of rhetoric from police leaders, and yet police continue to be the tool that's used to manage the problems in poor communities, especially non-white ones.
Yeah, it's also vastly expensive, right, in so many ways. The prisons, the police, the whole rest of the system. That money could be used for something that would be much more socially productive.
Well, that's one of the main points of the book, is that the decision to turn social problems over to the police to manage is a political decision about budget priorities, but also about an ideology that says the problems that these communities experience are the result of individual and group moral failure that will only respond to punitive interventions. And the alternative to that, that they don't want to address, is the fact that these problems are generally the result of market failures, housing markets, job markets, and also the failure of government to provide any kind of social safety net. So as long as we continue to invest ourselves in or embrace this idea that police and jails and prisons are the solutions to our problems, we're undermining the arguments that say what we actually need is investments in communities and reforms to labor markets, et cetera.
Let's talk about the reforms. You do a lot of discussing of police reforms, some of which are really good. Some of which, though, in fact, in reality, strengthen the police and do very little good.
Yeah, so I think it's crucial that we have a deeper understanding about what the nature of policing is before we start deciding on what kinds of interventions are going to reduce the burden of policing on communities. And I think too often people are caught up in a kind of liberal legal formalism that imagines that if the police just enforce the law more professionally and in a less biased way with more community oversight, that this would fix the problem. So they invest in things like anti-bias training, community policing, civilian oversight boards, body cameras, but there's actually almost no empirical evidence to show that any of those interventions have any meaningful impact on the problems that police produce in communities. And that's because the institution of policing is typically the wrong tool to use to solve these community problems. And that when we use police to deal with drug overdoses, homelessness, mental health crises, failing schools, what we're doing is we're saying we want to turn those problems over to the forces of violence and coercion, which have always been rooted in a kind of racism. And the alternative has got to be to look to those reforms that don't try to just restore legitimacy and public trust to policing, but that actually move us away from using policing to manage problems. So, for example, in every city in the country, we have policing on demand to deal with drug problems, but in almost no place in this country do we have high-quality drug treatment on demand. And so we've got to shift the conversation away from giving the police more training, more resources, more professionalization to why are we using police to solve these problems.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7, Portland, Oregon, talking to Alex Vitale, who wrote the wonderful, accessible, exciting, actually profound book, The End of Policing. We've so far discussed how today's policing creates great harm, particularly for the poor, at vast expense. And he discussed alternatives to policing in dealing with mental health crises and drug abuse. Some of the reform alternatives that turn out to do not much. But Alex, you talk about also some reforms that you think are valuable, like, let's say, drug courts, which really, to some extent, if they're done right, operate like social service agencies that first evaluate the problem and then provide help to people to, in fact, escape the thing that they really do want to escape in almost all cases, the drug addiction.
Well, so, there is some criticism of those programs in the book. That by placing things like mental health services and drug treatment services in the correctional system of courts, with backed up by threats of incarceration, this is actually often counterproductive. So we don't want that people end up with access to services only because they've been arrested by police. So instead of emphasizing the provision of services through courts or initiated by police contacts, why can't we just have high quality drug treatment on demand? Because there are a lot of people who would want to access that who don't have an easy way to do so. And also, we need to have robust harm reduction strategies in place to help save lives, stabilize people so that maybe they're in a better position to look for these kinds of drug treatment services that might make a more substantial improvement in their lives.
Right. I read an article that announced the opening or the establishment of a career center for people just released from jail so they can get jobs and get integrated into the community, which is a nice thing. But in your interview, you point out, well, it is a nice thing, but if, in fact, we don't create jobs for all, what the career centers become is just a helping device for a few people who happen to walk in the door. So people who have connections in this society get better jobs, even if they've made a lot of mistakes in their lives. And connections count. But for the great majority who don't have connections and who don't get into these very few sort of career centers, they don't get jobs. And as long as we have a society whose policies are to maintain unemployment and who have now abolished most public employment programs, even in periods of deep recession, that kind of program that the mayors talk about and the police even like, it doesn't make any difference at all, except it just promotes the idea that they're really concerned and are doing something about the welfare of ordinary people.
Well, they're doing a few things, right? One is that they're promoting that false sense that they're doing something, but also they're promoting the ideology of personal responsibility so that they frame this question of unemployment as one of personal failure. So that It's not that labor markets are organized badly. It's not that there's discrimination. It's that you didn't do what you were supposed to do to get a job. And by creating these kinds of training programs or job pipelines as part of reentry programs, if you don't actually increase the number of jobs, you're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak. So what we've got to have is actual economic development programming that's about creating new jobs, not just rearranging who gets the jobs that already exist.
In the book, you do accept the decent intentions of people, of most people in some in those programs like citizen review boards and creating jobs and helping reentry and all the rest of the stuff that people do. To those people, you say, look, these things are okay, but we really have to work to make this a more fair and just society where people can look forward to good lives and a society that doesn't destitute 20% of the people and drive them to desperation and into work that's defined as illegal, and another 40%, in fact, who experience enormous precarity and sometimes fall into desperation as a result. Unless we change that, we're not going to get very far. What is your suggestion to those people who are honestly sort of nice liberals who want to do something and who may not really agree with that analysis? How do you suggest that they work in their programs to advance that larger agenda?
To me, the most exciting organizing that's going on across the country right now are places where people are working at the neighborhood level to identify non-police, non-criminal justice solutions to the very real problems that their communities experience, whether it's drug overdoses or youth violence or people experiencing mental health crises or domestic violence. And they're coming together to try to figure out what would make their communities stronger and safer, and then demanding that government provide the kind of services that will do that, and pointing out the ways in which policing is not part of the solution and how we should be shifting resources from policing and jails and youth facilities to really creating neighborhood safety at the direction of local residents. So I encourage groups to look in their own communities at what the kinds of problems are that are generating police responses and articulating what you would really like to see. Why can't we have adequate community-based mental health services so that I don't have to call the police? Why can't we have safe injection facilities? Why can't we have community-based anti-violence initiatives in our community? These are the things that will make us safer without criminalizing young people in the community.
Alex Vitale, thanks so much for talking to us. So long.
Bye.
Well, that concludes our program for this morning. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. I want to thank our guests, Lauren Regan, Alex Vitale, and Garrett Ruppenhagen, and thanks to our supporters out there supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. You can find us on the web at KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Enjoy your Monday. We'll be right back.